This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 2nd of July 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 38th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. On this show, we're allowing ourselves to become really quite abstracted at times, in an artistic way, and then at other times we'll get very real indeed. We hope you can spot the difference between those poles, and we hope you enjoy the balancing act that we're trying to perform on this edition of Culture. Don't believe me? Just listen to this, what we call the show menu. Our man in Copenhagen visits the Den Frie, Centre of Contemporary Art, to check out the Life Clock. It's not the sort of clock that will get you up in the morning, but might be the sort of clock that keeps you awake at night.
But the ball is on the floor, stuck, stick on the ground, but the light are still turning.
It's quite heartbreaking to see a broken glitter ball like that, you know, because it represents so much pleasure and fun for so many people.
Back in London, we go and see an artist called Jacob Hashimoto as he finishes hanging his installation piece made of hundreds of paper kites.
It's taking the room and creating a sculpture that's like walking into a painting. So, you know, you create these kind of sculptural environments. And as a viewer, your role is completely different than as opposed to looking at a landscape painting. You're kind of the star of the show.
We vamos to Madrid to report on the remarkable, surprising success of a micro-theatre that's allowing new playwrights and audiences to watch bright, live, short things.
You decide if you want to see one play, if you want to see five, if you want to see two, you are free to design your own afternoon.
And a Mexican newspaper dedicated to fighting the drug wars, the documenta Art Extravaganza in Cassel, and some wonderful songs from our pals at Kitsune. It's Culture, it's Monocle 24, deal with it. But what always happens first in these circumstances? What do we normally do? What's the whistle that starts the match? Yes, of course, it's a song. This week we're picking tracks from our album of the week from Kitsune in Paris. Their new compilation is a special summer thing called Kitsune Soleil, selected and mixed by Gilles Lalouec and Jerry Boutier. From it, this is Hermes, featuring Ghost Tape by Ferro Black Magic. Way to start a show. That was Hermes by Ferro Black Magic from Kitsune Soleil, out 2nd of July. We'll be hearing more from that later. Now to Copenhagen for the start of a bit of an art odyssey today. Every year, Copenhagen's Den Frie Centre of Contemporary Art is taken over by a group of local artists to create the summer show. This year's show, Life Clock, which runs until the 12th of August, has been curated by art group A. Kassen. Monocle's Copenhagen correspondent Michael Booth went along to meet some of the organisers and artists involved.
What Copenhagen's Den Frie Udstilling, the Free Exhibition Hall, lacks in size, it more than makes up for with charm. This 120-year-old wooden pavilion in Østerbro is part Masonic lodge, part Chinese theatre, and it's the home of the first artist association ever founded in Denmark. I'm going along because its annual exhibition usually features some of the most radical, thought-provoking and occasionally hilarious contemporary art in the city. The first person I bump into is one of this year's curators, Tommy Peterson of A. Kassen.
Okay, we wanted to show people which art we like, artists we like, which inspire us.
So what links the pieces here?
Yeah, probably be like a meeting with the outside world, maybe.
The title of the exhibition is?
It's Life Clock. It's actually taken from a piece that's in the show, which is from Bertrand Plains.
My name is Bertrand Plan. You can say Plains. From Paris, and we have two pieces in this show. One is called Life Clock, which is also the name of the
exhibition, right?
Yeah. And another one is called The Place We've Been.
As I understand it, it's a clock, but the time has been recalibrated to human lifespan of a French average Frenchman.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. It's a very simple clock, but just the system is. It's a bit changed, and the clock is slowed down simply 60,000 times.
Yeah.
And the needle from hour make a turn each 84 years, which is the average life length in Europe. Maximum. But I wanted just to have something to help myself to be more in the present. You know, it's a kind of tool, so just producing tools. This one is one of my tools, just to not to be tricked by the normal clocks you have, which give you the impression, the feeling that you are always you're kind of eternity, you know. And everybody say when they have a nice experience of life that you should live in the present, and but it's not very easy because you have to experiment many things to. So it's a kind of experimentation, and it's also about life, because a lot of people see something about death, because of course it's
not a countdown to the end.
No, because there is no end. There is no end. The clock doesn't stop.
And the other piece you have here?
Yeah. The other piece is.
So now we're walking into a hexagonal room.
Octagonal
room. Yeah. With kind of smashed glitter ball, large glitter ball in the middle. As if it's been dropped from the ceiling, and around us in the diorama are like lights reflecting off the glitter ball. Tell us about this. What's the piece called?
The Place We've Been. It's installation made of a disco ball, a broken one. We found it in the second big city in Denmark. I don't know its name. I don't remember.
Aarhus.
Yes, in one of the most famous disco places in the 80s. You know.
So, ah, right.
You know, I don't know the name, but. Everybody speaks about it and say, the disco ball, I've danced under this ball when I was young. So, well, there is a story. And we broke it. We let it fall from the...
You did actually let it fall. It's not been artfully placed as if it's fallen. You actually dropped it from the ceiling.
Yeah. You still have the engine turning. Yeah. Everything is okay. But the ball is on the floor, stuck on the ground. But the lights are still turning.
I feel overwhelmingly sad when I see that, because it's like the end of something.
Yes, right? It's the end, but it's still alive, you know?
It's quite heartbreaking to see a broken glitter ball like that, you know, because it represents so much pleasure and fun for so many people.
Yeah, I know, it's a kind of allegory, you know? Many allegories, something ending, but for me it's more like a story, like a love story, very strong love story which ends, which is finished, you know? It's never finished, it's still continuing.
My name is At Phung Dang On.
At, from Bangkok, has been busy in the weeks leading up to the opening, building a kayak out of plaster and wood, which now takes centre stage in one of the gallery's rooms. Gallery visitors are apparently allowed to carry the boat, Out of the gallery and across was to Brogerda to the moat surrounding the old Fort Castell, where they can try and sail it.
And the idea is that you want to kind of bring art out of the gallery into the real world.
The idea, like, I would like people to view my work, have like a function. That's the idea. Not like make a sculpture and put in their room. I think they should have more thing on that.
And the idea is that people who come here to the gallery are allowed to take the boat.
Yeah, the idea, like,
and go out onto the city lakes.
Right. Yeah, the idea, like, they should have something with the boat, and otherwise they're dead boat. They should have a life on the boat. Yeah.
And you have also created this amazing dog over in the corner who's cocking his leg. And
stray dog.
Tell me what it's made out of.
The stray dog they make up by dog food.
Right.
Dog food and bed sheet and some resin. Yeah, because the idea, like, about a stray dog and the material should be in the concept of stray dog. That's why I made it.
What is it about a stray dog that appeals to you?
I tell story about the, you know, I am always stuck with the go everywhere because of the problem of the visa. But the dog, it, you know, stray dog, they can go everywhere. They don't need a visa. They are free. When they pee, they make a territory, and that's the idea.
This dog actually is peeing on the corner of the room here, and yeah. Do you must replenish his urine on the floor every day, or what?
The peeling, they can put the injector water inside. They have a system water in there, and they pee it out.
Oh, so it actually comes out of him?
Yeah, they come out, but when the water inside the dog is gone, you have to put it.
So you need to refill the dog every once in a while?
Yeah, it depends about, like, if you would like to have fun, you just feed it by...
Oh, with that syringe?
Yeah,
you refill him. Can I ask where do you refill him?
You want to see?
Yeah, show me where you refill the dog.
You see, they have a hole here.
Oh, in his arsehole. Right.
Yeah.
So you put the syringe in his arsehole.
Yeah, you're whistling it with the water inside.
And pump him full of water.
Yeah.
I leave At wrestling with the problems of his stray dog's dicky bladder, and I'm on my way out of the gallery when someone grabs me. Oh, you're not going yet. The pizzas haven't arrived, she says excitedly. Now, Copenhagen pizzas are pretty rubbish in my experience. The good ones don't deliver, so I'm confused by the woman's excitement, but she explains that the delivery is part of the exhibition. It is a piece of art. And at that moment, a couple of confused-looking pizza delivery boys arrive at the gallery bearing their large insulated bags. Then more arrive, and soon the receptionist is walled in by smelly, steaming cardboard boxes. A little while after that, the artist responsible, Simon Dubrow-Müller, arrives, rather breathless and sweaty.
The piece is called Delivery, so I guess it's somehow about, like, it's about expectations and stuff like that, and about kind of making the right delivery or something. And then, of course, it has all these implications, like all this kind of the messiness of the logistics of it, all these guys kind of meeting each other, normally kind of come from all these different areas, and all of a sudden they meet each other.
It's kind of a cross-community pizza delivery boy meeting kind of scenario.
I guess so, yeah.
Bringing the pizza community of Copenhagen together.
Exactly.
Simon later admits that he had actually come directly from the airport, hasn't ordered the pizzas himself, hasn't paid for the pizzas, doesn't know how many have been ordered or how much has been spent on them, and I have to admit, by this stage I was more than a little perplexed by his piece of art. What was the artwork? Who was the artist? The work is supposed to remind us of funny pranks, he says. But who is this prank at the expense of, I wonder? As I cross Österbrogade outside the gallery and make my way over to the station, I pass another stressed and confused-looking pizza delivery boy clutching a printout of the address of the gallery in one hand and a pile of pizzas in the other. I point him back in the direction of the gallery and head home.
That was Michael Booth, Arse and All, reporting on Life Clock in Copenhagen. We'll be meeting artist Jacob Hashimoto after this.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing, looking at the most inspiring people, places and ideas from around the world. Whether it's a bookshop owner in Toronto with a smart new business model, a fast food entrepreneur taking Japan by storm, or a local bank CEO providing microfinancing in Kenya, our correspondents and editors are on hand to provide insight into self-started success. Each week we'll be talking to enterprising people who have taken the leap and followed their dreams to set out on their own.
This is not just purely a business. This is a lifestyle. It's fun. It's great. I wake up in the morning, every morning, excited about what are these crazy ideas going around in my head.
From branding your company to finding startup financing and surviving the tough times, we cover the full range of what it takes to turn an idea into a thriving business. All told through personal stories from real people finding success by following their ambitions. That's The Entrepreneurs every Wednesday at 1900 UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Off we trot now to London's Daring Street to peep our head round the door of the Ronchini Gallery. Are they ready for us? Not really, but that's the best bit, when you can chat to the artists as they're hanging their show. The artist in question is Brooklyn-based Jacob Hashimoto, who makes installations that might be sculptures that are like walking into a painting, as he puts it. The ceiling's being hung with hundreds of floor-length, intricately made, wooden-framed, varnished paper shapes that will make a forest of colour and texture for the viewer to wander through come opening night.
You walk in and it's got this real, you know, symmetrical sort of landscape sensibility where you have an obvious focal point. Once we start throwing those things in, things are going to get a lot sloppier. Just formally, they're going to get sloppier. So if I can control them and compartmentalize them a little bit, then I'll use them. If they're going to be distracting from the rest of the composition, then I'll pull them from the show.
Walking in, as we've just done, to the hang of the show, Jacob, it kind of looks like there's obviously a method in it, but it looks sort of like there's a randomness to it. How random can you allow yourself to be, or do you know? I mean, we're talking about pieces of paper and pieces of varnished and laminated paper, most of which are maybe like 8 inches wide, 6 inches tall, and there are thousands already hanging out there.
Yeah.
So how prescriptive can you be? Do you know where every single piece goes?
Well, with the cube, obviously, those pieces were built and chained before we came here to make that shape, so it's very specific. The grid pattern that we're working with is very specific as well, so you can, if you looked at it from above, you'd see that everything is spaced on this grid. Given that, you know, we've opened up the form and there are these kind of tendrils that drift across the space, that stuff's pretty intuitive, and so we've been going in and like I'm doing the center section right now and these guys are doing the sides, and we're going to go back in and mess up what they're doing. But it's hard for me to explain where I want things to separate and where I want them to stay together. So we've kind of prescribed a direction of movement that I want them to move in, and then I'll go back in and separate it based on that.
It's part of the idea that as people walk through it, it's kind of like getting lost in a forest or something. Is there a natural element to the way you do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's part of that kind of tradition of room size painting, you know, the Jessica Stockholder sort of sensibility in terms of, you know, taking the room and creating a sculpture that's like walking into a painting. So, you know, you create these kinds of sculptural environments and it changes, you know, as a viewer, your role is completely different than as opposed to looking at a landscape painting. You're kind of the star of the show. So it's becomes a stage, you know, that's aesthetics are kind of based on your physical characteristics. So like kids love the work because it's totally kid size, but it's everybody's size because perspectively, it's, you know, it shifts constantly and it changes based on how you walk around it, how tall you are. It's artwork that's kind of very much about the viewer.
Can you raise these to here? This one? And this one? And then, Jameson, do you want to go back to the lab?
Sure.
I can knock out
the center. I came when the gallery opened earlier this year for the inauguration, and I got floor plans, so I knew how big the space was. But, you know, we had them take these pieces of wood and, you know, we cut them to spec when we got here, installed all the eye hooks when we got here, kind of decided on the wire configuration when we arrived. So a lot of stuff was really on the fly. I mean, the one thing that I knew is there was going to be this giant yellow cube in the middle of the room. And so everything else kind of was going to have to be built around that. And this sense of kind of landscape was key. You know, we're really flying by the seat of our pants.
See how flat it is? That piece that you just did. You can just bring this and the one onto the right of it if you bring it up.
People blow on them all the time. This is something fundamental. Like you see very dignified looking people just walk in, and when nobody's looking, they'll be like, just, I'm like, of course it's gonna move. But for the most part, people are pretty respectful. I mean, this body of work's been going on for, you know, about 15 years now. In all kinds of different cities, and I think the pieces are so fragile looking, and the overall installation feels so kind of precious and intimate that people don't mess with it. I mean, there's a respect that it kind of demands when it's done.
That's too much there.
I work with 6 assistants, and it's kind of like a big knitting circle. So, like, for example, they're working today, and they're doing we're doing a show in September in Chicago, and so they're preparing all these squares. I think we're doing 5,000 squares, and so they're doing, over the last 2 days, they've been covering white squares that are 8 inches on each side. So 4 of them are just sitting around doing that. The other 2 are working on parts of this other sculpture that involve these maple cubes that are going to get stacked into this whole other kind of thing. So day to day, that's kind of what that's, you know, that's, everybody's kind of tasked with different sort of repetitive tasks because everything is in multiple.
Well, let's maybe go into the back room quickly. We'll duck under this piece and dodge the yellow cube, and then maybe you can just tell us quickly about a couple of the smaller pieces.
Yeah, this is the odd one out of the group, I think.
Yeah, maybe we can understand the large piece, Jacob, by having a look at one of your small pieces. This looks a bit like a totem pole. It's still in its crate,
right?
Which I know you don't want us to see, but anyway, you're going to have to deal with it. The listeners are going to have to deal with it as well.
I used to make a lot of these long, narrow pieces, and I really don't do it very often anymore. We had a handful of frames left, and the pieces have been sitting around for 6 months or so because I wasn't really happy with the collage work, and we went back in and did another round of collaging onto them, and I'm actually really happy with the way it turned out.
And so this is as it stands, it's about 7 foot tall, and it'll be mounted on the wall on perspex. And again, it's this amazing idea of intricacy. Every single upended bow tie of a piece is presumably folded latticed varnished paper.
We thought of them as hourglasses, but yeah, upended bow tie works too, I guess.
It looks like possibly 1,000 wine waiters gave up their neckwear to provide you with that piece. But yeah, I guess we get an idea of your larger pieces written small there with the intricacy, the tying of the knots and the paperwork.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the thing with the small pieces is the materials are the same, the kind of mechanics of them are the same, but because they're restricted to wall space and they kind of deal in real true sculpture space, your relationship with them is different. And so the kinds of considerations that I have to deal with formally and in terms of the process are actually somewhat different too, because you read it like an object. And so you're the viewer looking at this object, as opposed to when you're dealing with the room size pieces, you're the viewer inside this object. So you've been subsumed by it. You're kind of part of that world. You know, this thing has to, these works have to exist kind of separate from your body.
You're an onlooker rather than a participant, I guess.
Yeah, you don't have that kind of physical relationship with them. I mean, obviously you do because of nature, but, you know, compositionally, I think that they're built different ways. You know, this piece over here, you know, employs kind of a scrolling video game sort of landscape composition. So you're really seeing stuff, you know, and I'm thinking about things in a real 2D space. And even within this group of work, actually, the one that you chose to look at first, you deal with it as in sculpture space. So you deal with it as an object. And the other pieces that are more painting size in terms of their scale, you know, maybe 4 by 4 feet, those you really deal with in terms of figure ground, in terms of kind of traditional painting space or pictorial space. And so the way that I think about them also shifts in order to kind of create that kind of, you know, relationship with the viewer.
That was Jacob Hashimoto and I talking through his show at the Ronchini Gallery in London, and that show's on until August the 28th. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Time now to get our media fix of the week. Mexicans took to the polls on Sunday to elect a new president, but what's it like being a journalist inside the country? Well, it's not always easy, especially not if you're trying to cover the drug wars which have so fascinated Western media. Threats and attack are constant, including car bombs and grenade attacks. At least 12 journalists were killed for their work last year, and 8 so far in 2012, including 3 on World Press Freedom Day. This makes Mexico more deadly for media workers than Somalia, Pakistan or Iraq. And some observers have declared that investigative journalism is dead. But from a small office in Culiacán, Sinaloa, the heartland of Mexico's organised crime area, the close-knit team of the weekly investigative newspaper Rio Doce has spent 9 years trying to disprove this myth and are championing investigative journalism, as Miles Esty reports.
¿Cómo está?
Y para ver si se puede lograr algo más.
Pues queremos platicar con ustedes.
Veteran reporter Javier Valdez heads out on a tip. Violence has displaced 40 people from their village in the Sierra Madre, and they are seeking refuge in the city. After several U-turns, he finds their temporary home in a dusty suburb of Culiacán, the state capital. Besides a collection of burnt pots and plastic bowls, the concrete house is barren. Some 27 people of all ages stand around. An old man, unsure of his age, tells Javier that masked armed men started showing up in their farming community. He says he doesn't know what group they're with. He guesses they killed 10 people in the small community. He doesn't know why. Javier listens intently as he jots notes. He will later remark that they seem terrified. He leaves his number and asks that they call if they need anything.
No, hombre, gracias a ustedes y mucha suerte. Ojalá que puedan regresar allá.
Dios lo oiga, Dios lo oiga. Ya le digo, sí.
Covering Mexico's drug war is a huge task. More than 50,000 have died across the country over the last 6 years, and 10,000 more disappeared. Roughly 100 people die a month out of the 1.5 million surrounding Culiacán. Javier says just one in every 100 of these gets solved. He sees the violence used to protect the networks that cultivate and transport drugs spilling into the lives of regular people in his home state of Sinaloa, the cradle of the drug trade. Last year, the Committee to Protect Journalists honored Javier's reportage on drug trafficking. It recognized his ability to put a human face on the effects of organized crime, corruption, and violence, topics most steer clear of. But reporting on these issues, Javier says, has come at a cost.
Esta vida que nos deja el narco.
This is the life that drug traffickers have left us, and the government operatives both have created this situation for us, of desolation, of risks, of threats, of a life filled with terror permanently. It's like quicksand. You move and you sink.
Javier has trouble sleeping. He thinks twice before being in public with his wife or kids. And he thinks constantly about the potential consequences of his stories. The risk and fear are not his alone. Editors and publishers across the country dodge topics of human rights abuses, corruption, and in-depth looks at the forces behind the drug war violence. Rio Doce circumvents this problem in a unique way. Founded in 2003 by Javier and three friends, they are the reporters, editors, and publishers. Now in their 50s, they remain extremely close friends. And the mandate remains the same: look into the issues the local publications they used to work for would not or could not touch. Aware of the danger, they collectively assume the ever-present risks of this coverage. This is Ismael Bojorquez Perea, Rio Doce's editor-in-chief.
It's not even necessary that someone threatens you directly. Covering drug trafficking is a constant risk, every single day. It is because of this that in Mexico, for many years now, there is so much self-censorship in the profession. But here, we've got to keep pushing on.
Ismael explains that they try to reveal as much as they can. Yet, they routinely encounter information that they know would get them killed for publishing. So as a team, they work to decide how to stay on the right side of what they refer to as an invisible line of danger. Essentially, how much they can investigate.
So you begin to draw a line and you say, what are you going to cover and what are you not going to cover? If I know there's a tract of land where small planes land and the police haven't discovered it, am I going to announce it? You have to consider all this when you decide you're going to cover drug trafficking here. The big problem is that the lines to be crossed are extremely thin and you don't see them. Suddenly, you cross them and you're on the other side.
This has not been a perfect science. Here's Javier again.
Una de ellos en septiembre del 2009.
One of the attacks, in September 2009, they threw a grenade. We were two blocks around the corner, not in the offices. We assume the people who attacked us knew that we weren't there, and we think they just wanted to scare us, which of course they did.
A cyber attack months later raised the same question for Rio Doce staff as the grenade had. Was this the Mexican government, the local government, the army, the police, the narcotraficantes? Javier says they just never know. You better stop the playing that you're doing. I said, watch out, I ain't lying. It's Friday night around 8, and Ismael has the CCR cranked off his computer stereo. Atop some medical offices and a beauty salon, Rio Doce will finish production of volume 487 in just a few hours. Ismael beams a sneaky smile. Like Javier, he lives for his job. Ismael jumps over to talk to two designers, both named Rafael, about a photo for a story on military corruption that will lead when the paper goes on sale Sunday morning. Last week, their front page story about a capo had been captured a month earlier, but that the government never announced, nearly sold out the 8,000 copies. This week, another series of stories will offer a nuanced peek into some of the complex forces behind the country's drug trade. And the editors will spend another week wondering if what they printed was on the right side of the invisible line.
That was Miles Esty in Sinaloa for Monocle. Still to come in part two, we'll polish the lenses of our horn-rimmed spectacles as we seek enlightenment and spot art trends at this year's Documenta Festival in Kassel. And we'll be hearing the answer to the question, Dear Robert, what on earth is a microtheatre? And I'll let you know what a minute of sound sounds like from a nightclub in Menorca. Took one for the team, didn't I? But first, let's have a bit more music. This from Kitsune Soleil, our album of the week. It's the Psych Magic remix of Metronomy's Everything Goes My Way. And that was freshly picked from Kitsune Soleil mixtape. And that was Metronomy as remixed by Psych Magic. You've tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. It's Monocle 24. Every 5 years, the art world meets in Kassel, a small city in the centre of Germany. The occasion is Documenta, known as the premier exhibition of contemporary and modern art in the world. Since its creation by Arnold Bode in 1955, Documenta has retained its importance thanks to a strong intellectual attitude. The 13th edition, directed by Italian-American Caroline Christoph Bokajev, with a team of curatorial agents, has an ambitious character. Sara Schifano went to the Brain in Kassel to discover a cerebral concept where art meets politics, science, philosophy, and where time becomes a flexible idea.
Two mostly empty spaces await the visitors at the Kunsthalle Friedrichshainum, the traditional location of Documenta. Ryan Gunder's breeze installation ruffling everyone's hair, together with the emotional sound piece Till I Get It Right by Seal Floyer, are the beginning of what, more than a simple art exhibition, looks like a mental challenge. Behind the first two minimalistic walls lies the Brain of Documenta, a fairly small and yet surprisingly rich space, which follows no ordinary rules. Chus Martinez, head of the curatorial department, explains.
The Brain, the space where we are in, somehow is the paranoid mind. It connects objects and times that are not connected. So you have the Bakhtian princesses, for example, from 4,000 years ago, connected with Morandi, connected with Horacio Larraín Peña, which is a fog catcher from the Atacama Desert in Chile, connected with Judith Hoff, which is a contemporary artist, connected with Lee Miller photographies.
A serious mind effort is required. After all, this is supposed to be the highest point of the art world. In the Brain, one of the secrets of this exhibition is unraveled. The connection between space and time goes beyond the traditional boundaries of chronology, geography, and specific fields.
And this happened in December and January. A whole host of...
Not far from the Friedrichshainum at the Neue Gallery, Italian artist Rossella Biscotti interprets this time and space warp almost literally, transporting here a piece of Italian political history with an overall theatrical effect. Suddenly, I'm in Rome, 1979.
Il processo, the trial, is a work that I have been developing in the course of a few years, and it comes all together in Documenta 13. As soon as you enter in the room, you see immediately the cast, the concrete cast. They are basically sculptures that have been made, the concrete has been poured directly in the courthouse where this trial was handled. And this courthouse is a really important building in Italy. It's called Aula Bunker, so high security courthouse in Foro Italico. Also an audio piece I have been working really long on, and is, as I said, it's 6 hours, but the original trial was 1.5 years, so I basically edited out of hundreds of recordings made by a free radio, Radio Radicale, into 6 hours that is almost like a theater piece.
Anytime, anywhere, anything. According to Chus Martinez, art has no temporal limits.
You think that you are in the contemporary because you are projecting your own perception of time on the object. But the object is not contemporary to us. It could be completely in the future of us. It could be in the past of us. Even it could be both in a paradoxical manner.
Up on the first floor of the Friedrichshainum, Christoph Scheff, a young scientist from Zeilinger's team, explains patiently 5 milestone experiments in the history of quantum mechanics to a fairly science-ignorant public.
It's very interesting. So normally, of course, I'm used to speaking to scientists, so we use different languages, of course, and somehow it's also very hard to describe quantum mechanics with your normal language. So if I say particle, there is no particle in quantum mechanics. My colleagues, of course, know what I mean, but here it's different because everybody is from a different field, of course.
It is clear that the core of this Documenta is the notion of artistic research. This characteristic is literally embodied by a massive editorial project, 100 notebooks for 100 artists, a series of books that sums up all the exhibition logics, as Chus Martinez explains.
In thinking about how can text accompany an exhibition, we thought about the relationship that you establish, for example, with a detective novel. So there is an enigma, and then you need to produce clues to discover to just solve this enigma. The enigma, clearly, 2 or 3 years before, and still a week before now, is the exhibition. The clues were the notebooks.
Documenta is a place where artists showcase at its purest state. However, even though nothing is officially on sale here, it's hard to think that an event like this won't have an impact on the market development. For Monocle, in Kassel, this is Sara Schifano.
Well, there you have it. And if you fancy popping along to soak up some highbrow art, Documenta will be on in Kassel all the way until 16th of September. And this is Culture on Monocle 24.
The Antwerp Academy of Fashion has a reputation for turning out some of the most cutting-edge designers of the day. It's where rising stars are discovered and a heady place to witness the impulses of Generation Next. We travel to Antwerp to scout out students on the threshold of success.
Fashion for me, first of all, it's a research. It's a research about the human, it's research about who they are, how they think. I start really looking up for images of sleeping beautiful women. Surprisingly, I found it in horror movies. So all the pieces are made with a red thread only. If you come closer, you will see that the blood really runs in a garment.
You can watch this film and many more from affairs to business, culture to design in our program archive on monocle.com.
For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture, where we're treading off to Spain for a new theatrical experience. In what was once the seediest part of downtown Madrid, in a small theatre complex in Malasaña, a new take on contemporary theatre is taking the city by storm. Our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, went to see what all the fuss was about.
The first day, suddenly we met 150 people waiting outside in the acera. And there is when we realized that it could be a success, because that very first day we were that surprised. Even the police came to see if we were drug dealers or we were, because it was very, very strange.
Strange indeed. Stranger yet is that El Microteatro, or micro theatre, was first established in a renovated brothel. The bordello turned theatre was then so successful that an even bigger space was found in an old butcher nearby. Founder Miguel Alcantuz explains the concept.
We do close-up theater. I mean, there are short plays, less than 15 minutes, for an audience less than 15 people. In a room, very small, is 3 per 3 meters. So the thing is the proximity. You are not seeing the play. You are in the play. You share the space with the actors, so you can feel it. It's like a trip. Possibly one of our main goals is breaking this fourth wall. The point of breaking this wall, the importance is that when you have this fourth wall, the actors are playing for the audience who are in this fourth wall. So the audience is in one place, the actors are in the other, and audience are watching to the actors. If you don't have this fourth wall, the actors act 360 degrees. So they can't escape, they can fake. They have to play always, because they have people all around looking at them. And for the audience, they are inside the play. They are not watching the play at the distance. So they can feel what the actors are feeling. We don't have really rules. I mean, we can make some indications for people to make it easier. There are some screens in which you can see when your play is going to start. We have 5 rooms, and each room makes 6 times the play every day. So we make like 30 plays a day. You decide if you want to see one play, if you want to see five, if you want to see two, you are free to design your own afternoon. So we have these screens in which you can see what is happening, so you can decide what do you want to do. Once your play is going to start, we have this reception bell that indicates you that you have to go to the play. You go downstairs, you have some kind of decompression room in which you can wait about 1 minute so that you forget the exterior world and you are preparing to go inside our world. And then you go to your room, you enjoy your play, you clap if you like it, you can't hit the actor if you don't like it, it's not allowed. And you decide what you want to do next, if you want to go to the bar, if you want to see another, or you decide. So every month we choose a theme for money, for love, for sex, for God, for everything. And every month we change the whole program. We have 19 new plays every month.
And who are the actors and the directors and the writers that are involved in the micro theater?
We like to mix well-known people with absolutely beginners. We are proud of being developing talent. We are giving the chance of a lot of people for writing or acting for first time in front of people, for an audience. So we receive about 100 plays a month. But we bet on people. Sometimes we win, normally we win. Sometimes we have lose, and that's horrible. But that's the point, is to discover new people, to develop new people. Obviously, when you open this process to non-professional people or people who are not used to write, you have to read a lot of bad plays, but you can find treasures inside this big amount of plays.
I sat down with one such treasure, Spanish actor Javier Ambrosi, and asked him what it's like when the audience is the stage.
Sometimes someone talks to you, and that's weird. But I think the main difference is the voice. Some actors will think that acting in a big space is easier, but I don't think so. Because in a very big space, you have to use your voice, and you have to have a very well trained voice in order to everybody to understand and to listen. But if you're in the microteatro, you can use your own voice, you can be loud, you can be low, you can create an intimacy very easy. It's not like in a big theater that everything is over and the people go to their house, you go to your own house. No, it's like, okay, the play is over. Now I can see your face. I could be very ashamed and that's the fact that when I don't do it good, I feel ashamed.
And do people say things or can you?
Yeah, like, oh, that was okay. Or give me a kiss. Or oh, was great. Or I didn't like it. Something like that. It's like, it's a very real response.
When we design the programmation of each month, we try to choose 5 different plays, not only in comedy drama, but also some more conventional plays and some more radical things. It's our bet. We want to be radical, and people know that they are going to be into this theater whole house, and anything can happen to them. They are free to complain, they are free to go.
So what about the audience? I talked to Borjan, an Australian traveller who, for the record, didn't abuse any of the actors he saw.
I think you get the feel of the stage a lot more. It's pretty much like you're a part of it. And I think you can tell the difference between good and bad acting a lot more when you're that close to them. I also think that the sounds and the noises made in some of the shows were fantastic. Even the speech, everything in close proximity means a lot more, I suppose. I don't know. I guess it adds a lot more meaning. I thought it was pretty cool. Yeah.
And would you come back?
Yes, definitely. Countless times.
Y espera, toma esta manzana para el camino.
And that was Liam Aldous on the Micro Theatre in Madrid. back by popular demand, is our 1 minute of sound. And you'll never guess where I've been. Minorca. And this is what I brought back.
Por tanto, es el momento de escuchar a Ismael Arranz con la información.
Amor, camareros. And that brings us to the end of this week's show. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and Holly Fisher did a lot of magic too. We can squeeze in another song, can't we? Our album of the week this week is Kitsune Slay, tracks selected and mixed by Gilda and Jerry. And this is Running From, featuring Violentness by Moon Boots. Thanks for tuning in.